All right. So this time we've got a couple of thread chapters, which part of what I find fun is seeing the way in which issues that arise in sort of exotic places like traditional Jewish or Islamic law then really get echoed in modern American law, because really sort of all societies face about the same problems. And let me start with the issue of embedded legal systems. Actually, let me start with you. What struck you about these things that you'd like to talk about? And then I can talk only if you don't have anything to say. Anybody? Yes.
This goes on a. This might be covered later, but so I want to have the Chinese law for the purpose of all that my favorite. But to the extent we're using extended family as a governing unit, that seems to me like an embedded or polylegal.
That is more embedded than polylegal in that you don't have a choice of whose family you're going to be in, but except I guess if a woman marries, she does to some extent. But yeah, no, it's true. I hadn't thought about the extended family. I don't know if I mentioned the example of a corporation or of a university, that after all, SCU has an embedded legal system, that I presume there are things you could do that would get you in trouble with the university that wouldn't get you in trouble with ordinary law. There was, in fact, one interesting, I found somewhat shocking case in a way at Caltech a good many years ago, which I got interested in because it had to do with computer issues, where you had a legal dispute in which two students accused a third student, who was the ex-boyfriend of one of the two, of various offenses. He ended up spending some months in prison awaiting trial under rather unpleasant circumstances. The jury took like half an hour to acquit him of all charges, and Caltech then expelled him. And my reading is that Caltech were the bad guys in that case. That is, that's partly because I got into it because it was a case having to do with email evidence early on, and the Caltech students were about, you know, a decade or two ahead of the rest of us in terms of sophistication. So it looked as though it was a case in which the essential evidence involved something that at first glance had been forged by A as from B, but it looks arguably was actually B and C making it look as though A had forged it from B in order to get A. So it was sort of this kind of a case where it was unclear what had really happened. And I originally corresponded with or spoke with a Caltech attorney who gave me an account of the case. I was then able to get in touch with a professor who had been a supporter of the student who got expelled and eventually with that student's lawyer. I concluded that the Caltech lawyer had been lying to me, or at least deliberately leaving out essential facts, which makes me somewhat biased against them, but I still don't know for sure what happened. But that was clearly a case where Caltech had its own disciplinary procedures, and after the procedures of the government had found him innocent, they, in effect, found him guilty and expelled him. I should say this was a student who I believe had gotten the highest score in China on whatever their equivalent was of the sort of SAT kind of exam. These are the one who got expelled. These were a group of three Chinese students in this particular conflict. And arguably, the reason that two of them were trying to get the third was that the third was threatening to report back to people in China damaging things about the two, which might have affected their families and so forth. But one doesn't really know. If you're sufficiently curious, my book, Future Imperfect, is webbed on my webpage, and I refer to Caltech as Silicon Tech, if you want to look up. I anonymize the whole story there, but you can get the details of it. And it's an interesting story, somewhat. But anyway, but that was an embedded system, and we have an embedded system, and corporations have explicit or implicit embedded systems, and so forth. That's true. Yeah.
Something that's kind of always troubled me since starting to study the Constitution is the way the Supreme Court can kind of just manipulate text and create whatever policy outcome they kind of see fit. And just like something that I noticed in the review that you pointed out that I don't think it's really like brought to light as much as it should be. And the other thing I'm kind of curious about is like how these Islamic and Jewish scholars of law kind of come about to become the authorities of the law. You know, I mean, whether they're kind of just de facto authorities or what, and like how that's different from the way Supreme Court justices are.
But notice that in the case of the Supreme Court also, ultimately, they're authorities by their own declaration. That is, Marbury versus Madison is the basis for saying that the Supreme Court can rule on the Constitution. And in order for Marbury versus Madison to have any force, you've got to believe the Supreme Court can rule on the Constitution. It's a circular argument. But in the case of the Islamic scholars, I think it's pretty clear that there is no formal credentialing process, that what's really going on is reputation, and that there are probably de facto tests. Does he know 10,000 hadith? If you talk to him, there's very interesting, if you're interested in sort of historical stuff, there's a book called by a man called Ibn Battuta, who is a, I think, 14th century North African world traveler. He's sort of the Islamic Marco Polo, about a century later than Marco Polo. And he comes, eventually, he sets off to do pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, as any good Muslim is supposed to. And he gets bit by the travel bug. And he goes down the east coast of Africa, giving us our only information on East Africa in the 14th century. He sets off for India because he has heard that Muhammad ibn Tughlaq, who is the Sultan of Delhi and fabulously wealthy, is very generous to foreign scholars in his court. And Ibn Battuta is a legal scholar. And so he goes to Delhi, spends some years as a judge in Delhi, eventually is sent on what's apparently an embassy to China, and he claims to have actually eventually made it to China. It's not clear if that part is fake or not, but he made it pretty far. But one of the things he mentions in passing is having met someone who claimed to be, I think, 300 years old or 200 years old, some impossible age. And Ibn Battuta says that I asked him some questions about traditions, and he answered obvious nonsense. What's going on? Ibn Battuta isn't sure if he's willing to believe the claim this guy is really this old or some. But Ibn Battuta is a professional legal scholar. If the guy really is 300 years old, he'll be a wonderful source for traditions because he's gotten 300 years earlier than anybody else does. But Ibn Battuta knows enough, apparently, to conclude that the guy's making it up. So he's, in effect, testing him by looking at his knowledge of the particular area that Ibn Battuta knows something about, concluding he's a fraud, so probably he's a fraud also about claiming to be this old, which I thought was really quite neat. But it also suggests that what will presumably be going on is that if you have a culture where there are a fair number of expert legal scholars, they can recognize each other, just as people in other fields can. So if you say, you know, I'm a mushtahid, I can deduce the law from the original sources, and I ask around and they say, that guy, he's a bluffer, you know, half the hadith he tells he made up himself, other people just aren't going to take you very seriously. I think that's what's going on in the Islamic one. Now, by the time you get to the Ottomans, you do have an official mufti appointed by the Sultan, but that's fairly relatively late. The Jewish one, in the early period, you've got an explicit Sanhedrin, so that you actually have a Supreme Court. You have a body of judges organized in some fashion. I don't know how that was originally set up. But the Sanhedrin is basically a dead letter by sometime in the 4th century. After that, you've got a reputational authority for the heads of the Babylonian academies, who are sort of considered the experts. But that fades by the 10th century or so. And after that, it really is all reputation. It really is all a matter of everybody knows that Maimonides is an extremely learned man, and we are persuaded, therefore, we'll accept his rule, or somebody else. I mean, you've got a sequence of these. I think the final one is, 15th century, I think Caro, C-A-R-O, I think is the author, but there's a book like Maimonides, except he's somebody who, if I remember correctly, does it in two books, one of which, like Maimonides, is giving one answer to each question, and one of which is giving all of the arguments, so that he sort of is feeding both ends of that dispute. Joseph Caro, I think is his name. I think that's the one. But in any case, but in each of these, it's pretty clear you don't always have one, but you at least there are times when basically all of the expert people say, oh, yeah, well, that's the best book on the subject, and we'll accept it. And if you think about how things work in modern-day academia even, that it's mostly a formal system in that you mostly won't become a professor in some field unless you have a PhD in that field, but not entirely. I have no degrees at all in either law or economics. My PhD is in physics. But nonetheless, I've been hired as a professor in both economics and law. And there are that's unusual but not impossible. So basically, if you write articles and get them published, and if they're good enough, so to speak, people say, yeah, we've heard of him, we've read his stuff, it's true, you know, he's sort of unconventional, he didn't come in by the usual pattern, but we'll hire him anyway. And then people do that. I think it was true of Gordon Tullock, I think there are a number of cases, though it's fairly uncommon. But that's got to be true. And I don't know. It'd be an interesting question in the U.S. how much we have gotten to a sort of credentialization of the world that computer programming is not. That there are occasionally proposals that you ought to have some kind of a equivalent of medical licensing for computer programmers. But the closest that exists, as far as I know, is that Microsoft gives out its own certificates to people who've taken courses in its software. But there's no legal requirement in order to do computer programming. You have to have any qualification. It's up to your employer or if you do it yourself. So it's really a mix here, and I think our society has become a good deal more credentialized over the last century or two. But anyway, the Islamic one I think not, and the Jewish one I think not, at least after the Sanhedrin is gone. And the U.S., of course, our legal system, the judges are officially appointed by a political process. But even there, think about the American Law Institute, the ALI. All right, it has no legal power at all, but it makes law because it's a body of highly respected scholars, and it publishes restatements of torts, basically, its view of what the common law is on some subject. And then state legislatures adopt part or all of its restatement into their law. So that's an example where the equivalent of the Islamic system is still alive and well in our system.
The Supreme Court justices aren't necessarily part of the ALI.
So no.
They're not necessarily legal scholars. Really.
That's correct. But my point is we've got more than one thing going on. And that if you think about how our law is actually being made, part of it is being made by the Supreme Court, which gets the final word. But sizable parts of it are coming out of opinions provided by experts who have no official position. You can think of the ALI as official, but it's a private organization. You can go even further, that presumably someone like Richard Epstein, say, or Judge Posner, affects the law. Not because Judge Posner is a judge, Epstein is not a judge, but because they write convincing books, they make arguments, and those eventually sometimes persuade judges. Right. So I think in almost any system, certainly in our system, you've got a mix of the official mechanism for making it, and then sort of the real mechanism for making it. And they sometimes clash. If you think about the whole controversy over Bork's appointment to the Supreme Court, Bork was really prominent not mainly because he had been a circuit judge, I think he had been, but because he had been a law professor, scholar, arguing for various views. And in that case, enough of his opponents prevented it. And Posner will probably never go on the Supreme Court, even though he's very, very prominent in terms of, ordinary measures, he's maybe the most prominent judge in the U.S., in terms of how much he's cited and stuff. But he has written enough controversial stuff that it's hard to believe any political position at all which he hasn't defended at one time or another with something he's written. So other comments, questions, discussions? Yeah.
I want to go specifically to
when
a son can be killed for this.
Yes, I actually printed all of that out. I thought it was neat because I hadn't actually read, I didn't remember that it was that. That was the chapter where I actually quoted a large chunk of it. Yeah.
Because from that passage in Deuteronomy, I can understand certain parts, but I don't understand the parts where there's
Yes. Oh, the meat, the glutton and the drunkard. The Deuteronomy says he is a glutton and a drunkard. However, the details of that, let me read it if people have forgotten, because I think it's sort of neat, the contrast between the original and then, I give only part of Maimonides' requirements, but if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, which will not obey the voice of his father, none of my sons are like that, or the voice of his mother, and that when they have chastened him will not hearken unto them, then shall his father and his mother lay hold on him and bring him out unto the elders of his city and unto the gate of his place. And they shall say unto the elders of his city, this our son is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. And all the men of his city shall stone him with stones that he die. That's the original text. And here is part of Maimonides. He is not liable for stoning until he steals from his father and buys meat and wine at a cheap price. Why a cheap price? I don't know. He must then eat it outside his father's domain, together with a group that are all empty and base. He must eat meat that is raw but not entirely raw, cooked but not entirely cooked, as is the practice of thieves. He must drink the wine as thin as the alcoholics drink. He must eat a quantity of wine of meat weighing 50 denarim in one sitting and drink half a log of this wine at one time. According to the oral tradition, we learned that this law concerns a youth of 13 between the time he grew two pubic hairs and the time at which his entire male organ is surrounded by pubic hair. After the entire male organ is surrounded by pubic hair, he is considered as independent and is not executed by stoning. If his father desires to convict him and his mother does not desire, or his mother desires and his father does not desire, he is not judged as a wayward and rebellious son, as implied by Deuteronomy 29:19. His father and mother shall take hold of him. If one of the parents has had his arm amputated, was lame, dumb, blind, or deaf, the son is not judged as a wayward and rebellious son. These concepts are derived as follows. His father and mother shall take hold of him. This excludes parents with amputated arms. What if they've only got one arm missing? And bring him out. This excludes the lame. They say, this excludes the dumb. This son of ours, this excludes the blind. Why, they can't recognize him. He does not heed our voice. This excludes the dumb. So that's just part. He keeps going on these requirements. And I think part of this, as I remember from looking at it at one point, is they're taking other bits of Torah, which have references, like the Torah somewhere talks about gluttony. And that they've got some passage, and they're saying, well, in this passage, they describe the glutton doing this, so he won't count as a glutton unless he does this. I think it's, my memory is that that's the pattern of the kind of thing they're doing. But they're reading all sorts of details that aren't in the original text, with some claim that they're deduced from elsewhere in the text. But notice also the reference to the oral tradition, because the oral tradition is one of the solutions in Jewish law, to the problem of how do you have an excuse for getting interpretations that sound implausible. And the answer is because the tradition was passed down, was given by God to Moses, passed down by Moses in oral tradition to us. And so we know that the official way of interpreting the written Torah is according to the oral Torah. And that was one of their outs, so to speak. But I just think it's a neat set of passages if you look at the way. I don't think it's any more exotic, or not much more exotic, than the claim that the power to regulate interstate commerce includes the power to control the crops that a farmer grows on his own farm to feed to his own animals. All right, that's the case on which the farm program is built. All right, that's a U.S. case from the 1930s, the second AAA case, where the first attempt to set up a farm program, the Supreme Court said that you have no constitutional authority to do that. And the second attempt after Roosevelt had attempted or at least threatened to pack the Supreme Court and then backs down, but the Supreme Court presumably is getting a little bit jittery at this point. And so then a revised version of the act they find constitutional. And the question is, where does the government get the authority to regulate intrastate activity? And the argument is because intrastate activity affects interstate activity, because if he hadn't grown those crops, he would have bought them. What he bought might have moved in interstate commerce, and therefore regulating interstate commerce includes that. And, you know, if you think about it for a while, you say, well, it's not completely absurd. How would you define interstate commerce in a really bright line fashion? Not quite clear. The Supreme Court finally, a few years ago, decided that rules saying how close to a school you could have firearms did not count as regulating interstate commerce. But they also found that rules regulating the consumption of marijuana in California, I think it was California, that was grown in California and was legal under California medical marijuana law, was interstate commerce and therefore could be regulated. And then the final case, which is interesting for another reason, is the Obamacare case, where the court this time found that it could not do it under regulation of interstate commerce, but could do it under taxation rules, which I'll get to in a minute, because that's sort of an interesting one. So at least the New Deal court ended up taking the position that and the New Deal court and almost everybody until, a decade or so ago, almost all Supreme Courts, really took the position that regulation of interstate commerce was almost a blank check for economic regulation of any sort, and they've now started pulling away from that for various reasons, but not all the way from that. But anyway, other things that struck people is interesting here. Yes.
I could think of a number of questions that I've always thought about in ways of comparing Islamic law to American law.
Yes.
But obviously I don't want that discussion to dominate.
Yes.
Discussion, but are there sources that one can go to where some of these thread discussions have taken place?
Yeah, but this kind of discussion, like I think of, there are certainly sources which discuss in detail Islamic law. The content, as I've discussed mostly, is not really the detailed content, but more the structure of the law and where it comes from. But of the sources, I offered, I think, three different alternative readings in the syllabus. And the one that is from Between God and the Sultan has, the chunk I had there, has some fairly detailed account of some of the content of Islamic law, where it overlaps sort of ordinary law. And I've got a book which I used in previous years before I found some of the, I thought, more interesting books, which also has, which I could lend you if you're curious. But that, but it isn't contrasting to U.S. law. It's really going through in detail. It's the equivalent, as it were, of almost like a case book, except that it isn't cases, but it's saying, this is the details of the law about this, that, and the other thing. About things like when you find a lost object, what are your legal obligations? But it's not discussing the modern ones. You'd have to look those up from other sources.
That would be very, very interesting. I'll send you an email.
I'll try to remember. If I remember, I'll bring that in Thursday because I'm not using it anyway. And I think it's sitting in my office at the moment, if I'm not mistaken. So, I don't know. I think the last time I think I taught this stuff, I spent more time going through the sort of nitty-gritty details of the law, but it seemed to me, after reading stuff I'd been reading between then and now, that in a way more interesting was the whole sense in which it was a decentralized maybe system, in which it disappeared for interesting reasons, sort of how it worked as opposed to the actual content. And the actual content, I mean, Jewish law and Islamic law, and probably even common law, have an awful lot in common. I mean, there are detailed differences. There are, the question of, I think the particular one which I think that book discusses in some detail is the sort of finder rule when you find lost property. And if I remember correctly, what he argues is that the common law really sort of thought that the primary rule was that the possessor owned it and the real owner could sort of get it back in some way. Whereas the Islamic law really takes the position that the finder is sort of a trustee, as it were. It's as if you had deposited something with him even though you didn't know you did it, and then it really still belongs to the original owner, and then the finder can do various things, and eventually, sort of one of the neat bits in there is that the finder is supposed to note things like how the thing was wrapped, and then he advertises without that information what he has found in order that when somebody claims it's his, he can check whether it's true by whether he knows the details. All right, it's really the same real approach that's used, that I mentioned the Visigothic law uses for confessions under torture. The question is it true? Well, do you know things you wouldn't know if it wasn't true? And that's sort of is a fairly powerful approach in lots of contexts. And then there are rules if you find an animal and you feed it, and I guess the owner then I think owes you compensation for the food and stuff like that. But that's Lost, Stolen, and Strayed, I think, is the chapter, as I remember, if you want to look at it. And that's sort of interesting. But I'm, at this point, I'm really less interested in those detailed rules, although they're certainly potentially interesting rules, than I am in sort of the common issues that run through, such as how you deal with inconsistencies between judges or how you change the law. So if I go back for a moment to the stuff to the stuff sort of implicit in what we were saying about how you can change the law, one general solution is interpretation. That's sort of what we were just talking about with Maimonides. And in a sense, it's always possible because you never have sufficiently detailed rules so there's no interpretation needed. There's a sense in which Chinese law, which we haven't gotten to, tried to do it, and it's pretty clear that they still don't. Even with a much more extensive set of rules than the Torah or the Quran, you still have this problem of what about things that fall between the cracks that don't fit the description. And so there's always some interpretation. Typically, at least for the Jewish and the Islamic cases, you try to find some excuse within the system for claiming that you get to interpret it. So the Jewish one, there is the text in the Torah which says that if it's unclear what the law is, go with the opinion of the majority. And that was interpreters, meaning the Sanhedrin by majority vote, can decide what the law is. And then there was this tradition of the oral Torah, which sort of gave you another way of doing it. As I said before, I find it very hard to tell reading this stuff, the Jewish stuff, how to what extent the rabbis really believed in what they were saying and doing. That is, were they people who said, well, yeah, I've got to have an excuse in the Torah, but I'm really figuring out what the law ought to be? Or were they people who really, in some sense, deeply believed that, yes, God told Moses these things which have been passed down to us, and even though they're not in writing, we get to decide, right? I don't know. But in the case of Islamic law, partly it's just that there's so little law in the Quran that you have to do a lot of interpretation in order to get legal rules. There's also the fact that the other big source is the Hadith. The Hadith were oral tradition for multiple generations. It's therefore pretty obvious that you can't be sure that a Hadith that now exists in writing is real. That means that the scholars have got to select out which Hadith they believe in. And while it's true that in principle they've got objective criteria, which are things like how many different chains of tradition are there which lead to the same conclusion, in practice, you've got to believe that one of the things they do is to say, well, this one implies a legal rule that I'm pretty sure is wrong, so I'll be very skeptical about the evidence for that one, whereas this one I'll be more. And maybe the clearest case is the Hadith, which justifies one of the ways they do it, namely consensus. Because the situation, the rule is that if all of the scholars are agreed, the question is settled. There did not exist multiple hadith with the exact same ending by different chains, which is what you're supposed to need in order to make it definite. But the argument was there are multiple hadith with different chains, all of which end up with essentially the same conclusion in different words. And that was held sufficient, and I think that probably was held sufficient because they really wanted a way of settling some questions, which Ishma does. So again, in the Islamic case, the need to have a interpretive methodology, that what seems to happen, I think most of the modern scholars would agree, that in the Islamic case, you start out with rules that aren't based on these sources. You then have disputes of what the rules should be, and people turn to the sources and develop interpretive methodologies, and according to who you believe, either on the basis of real hadith or on the basis of forged hadith, and that's something people disagree about, end up sort of recreating the system, some of what they had before and some of it different, but claiming it back to having divine authority, which was... One thing, by the way, sort of a digression, but I think an interesting one, that I discovered recently discussing Islamic history with my children, both of whom took the same course at University of Chicago in Fatimid history. And I didn't know much about the Fatimids. The Fatimids, Fatimid literally means a descendant of Fatima, who's a daughter of Muhammad. And whether the Fatimids are really Fatimid in that sense was a matter of dispute. But they were a North African dynasty that eventually took over Egypt and for a while held Syria. So they were a fairly major power about the 10th century. And they were Shia. They were Ismaili, Sevener Shias. And they were, I hadn't realized it, Shia in a tradition that held that there was still a imam living invisible among them. That the 12 were Shia position is that the 12th imam goes into occlusion and he's still there invisible. But there's no actual person you can point at. That, I don't know if that's true of some of the Seveners, but the Ismailis who were what the Shia, what the Fatimid were, their position was, you know, that guy right over there, he's the imam. He's told us he is. So you have a series of caliphs who claim to be divinely inspired, who claim to be almost like Muhammad, like the 12er imams. And one of them, Al-Hakim, who according to who you believe is or isn't crazy, is the one who sets off the first crusade because he decides to destroy the Christian churches under his control and destroys the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which was the event that results in the Pope preaching the First Crusade and the First Crusade showing up. And he does a lot of weird things. So it looks as though he probably really did believe that he was, if not quite God, at least divinely inspired. And therefore, whatever he said had to be true, kind of thing. So that's sort of interesting, because I think I mentioned that part of my interpretation of the Oven of Achnai story in Jewish tradition, this is the story where you've got the debate between Rabbi Eleazar and the sages, and Eleazar keeps doing miracles, and the sages keep ignoring them. And eventually the sages, in effect, excommunicate Eleazar. And my interpretation of that was that part of the function of that story is to say the fact you can do miracles doesn't let you make the law. So that because after all, you could have miracle workers who weren't really divine, it could just be good con men or something. And that therefore, even if God made the law originally, he's now passed the baton on to us humans, and therefore the human mechanism of the majority of the Sanhedrin is what decides it. Well, if you look at presumably the situation in Fatimid, in the Fatimid Caliphate, was there was still someone who claimed he could make the law, and who had the power to make that claim stick. And, you know, worked for a while, eventually that collapsed like most other dynasties. But that I thought was a little bit interesting, because I guess I had known more about the 12ers and less about the 7ers, and there are still 7ers around. That is, there are still, I think that the largest of the 7er group, there are 15 million of them, was the figure I saw. And the Druze are ultimately Seveners who decided that Al-Hakim was God, or was more or less God. That's apparently where the Druze come from. So whether they're Muslims would be highly dubious. I suspect that probably most Sunni would say they aren't, but they're coming out of a Muslim tradition. Also, I hadn't known, but they're still around. I mean, they're one of the players in conflicts in Lebanon, for example. But I think the main Ismaili groups I think are now all Indian. When I was looking them up, I was sort of interested that so you had converts there, small population in India, but still more than anywhere else. So one solution when God gets it wrong is that you interpret around the law. Another solution is you find some mechanism other than the mechanism that God is controlling, so to speak. So the Jewish law, there was the doctrine eventually during the diaspora that the communal authorities, especially if there was no halakhic scholar, if there was no expert in the law, could make law themselves, that after all, someone's got to settle these things. And one defense of it was that they had inherited the power of the king of Israel. Because if you look in the Bible, the king of Israel is doing stuff which he clearly has no business doing under halakhic law. And there's this passage in the Bible where one of the prophets warns the people about all the things the king of Israel can do if they are such fools as to appoint a king of Israel, which he doesn't think is a great idea. So the argument is, all right, the king of Israel is entitled to do these things. Therefore, the communal authorities have inherited his authority. He can do it. And that mattered because if you think about, for example, high standards of proof where you need two witnesses who warn the guy that what he was about to do was a capital offense and he did it anyway, and otherwise you can't convict him of a capital offense, that's not very workable if you really want to be able to convict anybody of capital offenses. If you think about not allowing judges or witnesses who have any relation to the defendant in a small community or related to everybody else, that may not be workable. So in various ways, that was one way around it. In the Islamic, the Ottomans, the sultans made their own decrees, the kanun, so that was a parallel legal system which did not follow the rules of fiqh or of sharia, even though it theoretically was just to sort of fill up the holes. You've got the police court, and you've got a couple of courts outside the formal rules of fiqh, all of which are being manned by Muslims, all of whom believe they're somehow implementing it, but they're not implementing it by the rules, and therefore they can use fewer witnesses or in various other ways do things that the official rules don't allow them to do. But it's also true if you think about the modern American case that in a number of cases, in a certain sense, let me go back to Obamacare. The argument is this restriction applies to regulation, but it doesn't apply to taxation. So therefore, you're entitled to say we have a special tax which goes on people who haven't gotten health insurance, essentially. That's how they're interpreting the mandate. And more generally, if you look at administrative agencies in the modern U.S. context, administrative agencies can make decisions in which you don't have a right to a jury trial, for example. They can do various other things. They've got their own rules made later. But they are in a certain sense functioning as a sort of a parallel executive plus judicial system, but not under the constitutional restraints on the executive plus judicial system. So that's another way of really doing the same thing. And another one I was thinking about, given that it was topical very recently, is the whole way in which lots of presidents have avoided the fact that the Constitution says that you need the Senate to declare war. All right, the U.S. hasn't declared many wars for a while, even though we've dropped bombs on people. And so somehow, well, Korea was a police action. I don't know if we ever declared war on anybody in Korea. I'm not sure what happened in that case. And clearly Obama's opinion was that he could attack Syria, he could launch cruise missiles at Syria without congressional authorization, even though he'd rather have congressional authorization. And we've had, I mean, that's been true. The Iraq war, I think, was never declared as a war, although there, in that case, I think a number of these things, there were congressional declarations authorizing the government to do something, but not in the form of a declaration of war. So all of those are examples. But another interesting mechanism, interesting because it's both one of my favorite medieval Islamic law and econ stories and very recent news, is by controlling enforcement. So that we've got this great story about the poet Ibn Harma and the caliph, where the poet says the reward I want for you for my great poem that I recited to you is that I be let off from being punished for getting drunk. And the caliph says, sorry, bud, I can't do that. That's God's law, not mine. I can't change it. I mean, you know, haven't you read this stuff about, didn't you read the book that law and the state are separate in our system and I don't get to make the law? And ask for something else. And Ibn Harma says, I don't want anything else. And the caliph says, well, and he sends instructions basically to punish anybody who brings Ibn Harma in for the punishment for being drunk. Right, so that if Ibn Harma is brought in for being drunk, sure enough he'll get his, whatever it is, 40 lashes, but whoever it is who brings him in will get 60. So what's the modern equivalent? We've had two examples from Obama within the last 6 months or so. One of them is Obama saying, well, I haven't been able to actually get any immigration reform through Congress. We'd like to work on that. So as an interim measure, we're just not going to deport the following particularly deserving category of illegal immigrants, which is basically, I think it was people who, it was some basically young people who haven't done anything wrong, that we know of. That's not an exact definition, but it was something like that. And recently, Holder announcing that they weren't going to enforce marijuana law in states where marijuana or medical marijuana is legal, except, and he left himself a whole bunch of outs. So if he wants to enforce it, he can still claim he's doing it, because one of the outs is unless the marijuana is going to minors or is going out of state. It is hard to imagine any structure of state law which in practice will prevent either of those happening. After all, it's illegal for minors to have alcohol, and as probably one of you, two of you have even noticed in your own life, minors get alcohol in our society at the moment. It's a very hard kind of law to enforce. So if he wants to, but at least the implication of that is that the executive arm of government has decided that we're not going to repeal this law, but we're going to stop enforcing it. So that's a mechanism. And again, it's very hard to see how you could avoid. I mean, you could say you're not allowed to say that, but how you could avoid really doing that? Because after all, there are always limited resources for enforcing the law. You're always making decisions about priorities. So if you don't like a law and they won't repeal it, you can always just tell the people in law enforcement to not bother enforcing it. Now, there is a solution to that problem. The solution to that problem is to use something like tort law instead of criminal law, because for tort law, you have private plaintiffs. So if you imagine, suppose that we made it tortious to smoke marijuana within 1,000 feet of my house. Now, Obama can't, without repealing it, prevent enforcement. If you had sufficiently corrupt judges, he could choose not to convict or anything. But in principle, one of the interesting differences between criminal law and tort law in our system is that criminal law prosecution is by the state, which means has a bunch of consequences. One consequence is that the state can in effect repeal a law without the legislature doing it. Another consequence is, as I think I commented in an earlier context, the king's friends can get away with murder. Because, or to take the real recent case with perjury. All right, we've had the director of national intelligence did what I think on any reasonable basis was commit perjury before Congress, and there's no chance at all that he'll be indicted because he would have to be indicted by his employers, essentially, and they were in favor of the perjury because he was hiding secrets they thought ought to be hidden, secrets about national security agency activity. So that's, I mean, it's interesting if you think about the whole question of tort versus criminal law. And one of the interesting things that seems to me that came out of all the stuff I was studying in teaching this course and writing the book is how common decentralized enforcement is in various past societies as well as our kind of centralized. And we have both, of course, because our tort is a decentralized system. And one of the advantages and disadvantages of criminal law is that the executive can decide which laws to enforce. Yeah.
So for certain crimes, like say homicide, we could apply tort law to it as well as criminal law.
Yes.
In sort of your model of tort, is instead of criminalizing certain laws, right? What about if you just added tort law enforcement on top of the criminal rather than making it only tort?
Yes, to some extent we do. That is, as I think I may have mentioned, the case that first got me interested in this issue a very long time ago was the Black Panther shooting in Chicago. And there, the survivors did sue in tort and did get an out-of-court settlement, fairly substantial at the time.
But what's the advantage of making it only tort?
It's an interesting question, and the answer is there are a bunch of alternative systems. You could also consider the Chinese system where it's all criminal. And I've really only thought through one of the proposals, namely all tort. And a mix of a tort and criminal, and I am not, the answer is I can't give you a fast answer, that I'm not sure. There's one problem, I guess, in practice, is that if you have a criminal punishment and it essentially wipes out the assets of the offender, then there's no incentive to sue in tort. But it's still the case that under our system there is the option if the government won't take action and the action is a tort as well as a crime, you can still sue in tort and do, of course, sometimes. Yeah.
Well, then there are those areas that don't overlap. Like, I mean, you can't sue the president for going to war without the advice of the Senate of Congress to tort, and you can't sue the head of the NSA for perjury
yes.
in front of Congress. So it's like,
yes,
I can see it being better if tort law did extend to all.
But you could, as you could imagine, what I think she's asking is, suppose what we said was that every crime is also a tort.
Right.
And then the problem is who has the claim. And one possible answer is anybody who sues and wins. You could make it essentially a bounty system. That we do that for some things, right? You don't want it dead or alive. There are various contexts, niches in the legal system where you have a bounty system, where you've got something like, I think it's private attorney general, I think is the term that's used for some of those private, I probably got it wrong, got the jargon wrong, but there are some specific statutes which basically say a private individual can initiate the case. In English law, it's still the case that a private individual can initiate a criminal case, although it's not very practical in practice. And that was, in the 18th century, that was called an appeal of felony. I don't know whether it's still called that in the modern law. I've wondered with all these NSA cases about the question of how one could bring it before the court, so to speak. That is, suppose the NSA is engaged in illegal wiretapping, which you can argue whether it is or not. I think it's engaged in wiretapping, which is dubiously legal, but which it's got opinions would say it is. And then the question is, suppose it's true, how could you ever get the case to the Supreme Court? You've got to have somebody who's got a cause of action. And presumably the NSA is never saying, I don't think it's ever saying in an ordinary court case, we charge you with this offense and our evidence is the result of this wiretapping. They're saying, rather, our evidence is A, B, and C, and the reason we got A, B, C, though we're probably not telling you that, is that we knew where to be, where to have our spies or our infiltrators or whatever, because of our wiretapping. All right, I assume that's what's going on. So I don't know. I mean, it's an intriguing question.
I think there are outlets for people who have been trespassed upon or have been otherwise wronged by government to sue government, like in a tort.
Well, there was one with regard to the telephone companies, and Congress explicitly immunized them after they had engaged in extensive torts against their customers. This was some years back, by releasing information which they were, I think, either contract or tort law, but which under the law they weren't allowed to release, and that became public, and so Congress retroactively immunized them. I think that's right. I'm pretty sure I'm remembering that sequence correctly. So anyway, but it's an interesting set of questions, I don't think it's as simple as saying one of them is obviously better than the other, but they are different in interesting ways, and we have too much tendency to think of criminal law as the only model, when in fact there are other models out there. Going back to the question of judicial uniformity, in a sense, the most interesting lesson is that you don't need it as much as you might think. That is to say that Jewish law from about the 10th century on, there really was no mechanism to give you uniformity beyond a single community because there was no Supreme Court equivalent. And Islamic law, at least until the system broke down at some point in the 18th or 19th century, there's no mechanism to give you uniformity in general because the mufti gives an opinion based on his reading of the legal scholars. The qadi presumably mostly believes the mufti's opinion. The legal scholars themselves may have, even within a single school, may have more than one. May say, well, there's a good argument for this and for that, and there are multiple legal schools. And yet both of those societies survived. And part of what's going on, I think, and it's going to be less true now, is that an awful lot of disputes are intra-communal. So that if almost all of your disputes are in the Jewish ghetto of Venice, that probably has a single court system with a single set of opinions, and the problem only arises when you have cross-communal ones. But it occurred to me that there's really the same issue exists at present, that after all, the world manages to survive despite the fact that there is no Supreme Court for the world. And I was just reading a story about, I think it was one of the legal blogs, and one of the South American countries, I think it's Argentina, but I'm not sure, is currently engaged in litigation in the U.S. And what's going on was that they defaulted on their bonds like 10 years ago. They had borrowed money from people outside of the country. And a bunch of the lenders reached an agreement, which I assume was paying off 60 cents on the dollar or something. But some of the lenders never joined the agreement. And now those lenders have found some way, I don't remember what the details are, but of getting around the sort of sovereign immunity kind of restrictions and suing, and apparently with a real case in a U.S. court. And I think their claim is that the country can't pay the ones who did settle unless it also pays them. And, of course, they're asking for 100 cents on the dollar. And the discussion I saw said that the country in question was, I think, appealing the decision that had happened gone against them. but it explicitly said that if they lost, they would not obey the judgment. That is, we have no way of forcing. So that's sort of suggests some of the problems with international law, and yet, you know, why does anybody lend money to foreign countries when you know that, that if that foreign country chooses to default, what are you going to do about it? All right. And yet somehow, you know, the world functions. We have international commerce and loans and so forth. So in that sense, you could say that the world as a whole is a polylegal system without a uniform form of enforcement. I remember noticing one of Kipling's poems, which is mentions a naval demonstration to collect debts from, I forget what country, or some South American country. And the particular context of the poem is that the demonstration was by several countries, including, I think, a country, possibly Germany, that Kipling thought had behaved very badly to Britain. So it was really, you know, why are you allying with our enemies in order to do this? But the implication was, I think, that several powerful countries could go to a weak country and say, look, you owe us money, and if you don't pay, you know, we may blockade you or something. I don't know exactly what was at issue. That would be a probably late 19th or early 20th century. But I think it would be very hard to do that one nowadays in most contexts.
What are the other incentives? I mean, when a country defaults on their loan, that makes it very likely that no one will ever loan them.
Well, that's a very interesting question. It could go the other way. Suppose you say, look, at the moment I'm not going to lend the money because they owe so much they're never going to pay it. So if I just put in more, I'll lose. But once they default, now they've got a clean balance sheet. Maybe if they want to reestablish their reputation. It would be an interesting question to ask whether the premium on loans, the interest rates companies have to pay, goes up or down after a default. One of my friends claimed that I once said, but I don't remember saying it, that a default is the only balanced budget amendment with teeth. That was your argument, that once you've defaulted, nobody will lend you money, so you've got to have a balanced budget. In order to balance, you've got to borrow money from somebody. But I'm not sure it's even true, aside from whether it was my line. It's great. It's a nice line, whether it's true or not. And I wish I said it, but Sieske claimed I said it, but I don't remember ever saying it. Anyway, so other things to go back. So far, I've really been talking about the second chapter there, which is God as legislator. And let's go back for a moment to the embedded legal systems, which are another interesting case. And in a sense, the big problem is how do you enforce your rules in an embedded legal system? And I think there are basically three ways you do it. One of them is to have delegated authority by the overgovernment, which is what the Jewish communal authorities did and what the groups in the Ottoman Empire did. Another way is to use to do things which are punishment from the standpoint of the people you're doing them to, but are not illegal in terms of the overgovernment. So that, for example, if SCU expels you for some offense against their rules, there may be some restrictions on that. I don't know what the rules are on when you can sue them for expelling you, but the normal rule, in a sense, is the college gets to decide who its students are, and therefore they can do that. And if you think about the logic of that problem, why does expelling you hurt you? More generally, as why does, if the punishment, as in many of the systems it is ultimately pushing you out of the group? And it seems to me that there are a number of possible ways that can work. One of them is that the group really is much better than anything else, and therefore you don't want to be pushed out. One of them is it's much better for you because that's where all your friends and relatives are. Or it's much better for you because you believe in their religion. If you think about a religious group and you therefore say, you know, do I want to associate with all of these people who are heading for hell, who are sinful people, or do I want to stay with the purified people who believe in the true religion, whatever it is. But one interesting element is sunk costs. And that's in a certain sense, if you think about the family case, the fact that even if it's not better initially, if you have spent a chunk of your life in this particular environment, you're an expert on how it works, you know Pennsylvania Dutch is your first language. You've got a whole bunch of habits and such that you're much more comfortable with these people. But it occurred to me that there's an artificial way of doing that, which would be relevant, again, for something like the university, and that's bonding. So suppose I've got a private organization. The only punishment I can give to people is to expel them. And I want to make sure that that's a real punishment so that I actually enforce it. Well, I say, when you come to join my organization, you have to deposit a bond, which forfeits if you're expelled. And that's, in a sense, sort of a contractual equivalent of what happens when you grow up in a society and have a lot of sort of social sunk costs of various sorts in that society. Does that make sense as an interesting way of thinking about it? And you can then think about how different institutions do or don't make that work. Now, one advantage of using legal forms of punishment is that you may be able to enforce rules the over-government doesn't approve of. So that, for example, the over-government doesn't approve of the social rule which says no gypsy should testify against another gypsy in court. I don't know if that's such a rule, but there probably is an effect. And you can't go to the government and say, well, look, he signed a contract agreeing not to testify against fellow gypsies in court, so let's sue him. But you can say, none of us are going to associate with him after he does that, and if that's very costly to him, that's an effective way of enforcing it. Sort of an interesting approach. There's a second-order enforcement problem, of course, and that is how do you enforce the shunning order? That because what you want is no other Amish will associate with you, or no other member of our congregation will associate with you, or no other gypsy will associate with you. How do you enforce that on the other Amish or the other gypsies? And one way of doing it, at least two ways that you observe in the actual institutions, one of them is a belief in pollution, a belief in some kind of a contagious bad consequence. So that you say, all right, he is marame, he is polluted, and one result of that is that if you have anything to do with him, pretty soon you'll be polluted too, and bad things will happen to you, you'll get sick or something. And that's the Cheyenne solution, as far as I can tell. The Cheyenne way of dealing with how do you prevent homicide within the tribe, given a society which doesn't have very much in the way of formal law enforcement and such, is that if you kill a fellow Cheyenne, you now smell of death, you're now polluted, and other people associating with you, the smell will smell to them, and you aren't going to have very good hunting. The animals will stay away from you. Things will have bad luck. You know, you might hurt yourself. So that kind of belief provides a mechanism for enforcing a shunning rule. The other mechanism that I'm familiar with is what I think of as the bootstrap rule. And that says failing to shun somebody who has been exiled results in your being exiled. And so, therefore, it's sort of a self-enforcing, sort of a circular rule, but a circular rule that can work. And I suspect that if you think about how it works in our society, that I think at any time in the U.S., there are defensible opinions you could express that it would be very imprudent to express. And I guess the extreme example of that would be Larry Summers. That Larry Summers, who, as you may know, has just withdrawn from consideration for chairman of the Fed. And some years ago, when he was president of Harvard, he had a talk at the National Bureau of National Bureau of Economic Research. He is, for some reason, discussing the question of why there are fewer women than men who are professors at Harvard. I don't know, was it professors of economics, but some subset. And he lists about at least three different explanations. And his third most likely explanation is the possibility that there might really be a difference in the distribution of abilities between men and women. So that maybe a larger fraction of men than of women have the particular abilities that make you a very good economist or something. He mentioned this is one possibility and goes on. And somebody reports this, and he ends up being driven out of the position of president of Harvard. Because, although as far as I can tell, the opinion that there may be differences in distributions of ability between men and women is a defensible position. It's not, you know, there's no a priori reason to be sure it's not true. And probably most people actually believe it, although they'll disagree about what the differences are. And, you know, some of them will say, well, you know, women are more empathetic, and men are more whatever. We know if you look at the crime data that men go crazy at about age 16 and recover at about 26 or 28. That shows up in not only crime data but in accidents, auto accidents. That's who has the auto accidents. And you can think of not implausible evolutionary reasons for that difference. Nonetheless, in the academic world, actually making that assertion is a very dangerous thing to do. And, you know, I'm not president of Harvard. I can afford to say it's a defensible position, but it turned out to be very expensive for him to do so. And I suspect that for things like that, you can, I'll let your own imagination think of what things, if you believe them, you would be reluctant to say in public in the particular circles you move in. And those are going to be different for different people in different circles. But one reason you're reluctant to say them is that you think other people would, in effect, shun you. And why would they shun you? Well, one reason is they wouldn't want other people to know that they were associating with an evil person like you, with a racist or a sexist or whatever. You can think of, I can think of other categories where the same thing would go on. And I suspect, and I don't think it's particular to any particular political ideology. I think you get the same pattern that if you were looking at a community where everybody was a conservative, there would be certain views that were defensible that would be imprudent to express. It views where everybody's a liberal, views where everybody's a Christian, views where everybody's an atheist. I think any of those, as long as you have a fairly uniform culture, you can get a, as it were, enforcement of norms just by sort of the low-level version of, it's not literal ostracism, but it's the knowledge that people will be uncomfortable with you if you break that set of rules. So it's also true that in some cases you can get the effect by a central mechanism. So that, for example, if the Catholic Church excommunicates you, it doesn't depend on all Catholics refusing to associate with you. All it depends on is all priests refusing to give you communion, since that's, I think, what excommunication literally consists of. And the priests in the Catholic Church are part of a single hierarchy running down from the Pope. Now, it would be much harder to do in some other churches. There are churches that are much more decentralized, and where if you tried to do that, I'm pretty sure it's the case that in the Episcopal Church, I believe there were parishes that were appointing women as clergy at a point before the Episcopal Church as a whole had decided it was legitimate to have women as clergy. That's a less centralized system, and therefore you've got less ability for the center to impose its rules on everybody. But that's a difference among different systems. But of course, you then have to worry. Certainly one would worry, if you think about the history of the Catholic Church, that if the decision to ostracize is made and enforced from the center, it might be done for bad reasons. It might be done not because you're sinful, but because you are an Italian city-state ruler who was a political opponent of the Vatican at a point when the Vatican was actually running a small state called the Papal States, or you think about other things of that sort. So... one of the interesting cases, incidentally, which we haven't been covering, I'm not sure if the paper may still be webbed, but it was a paper from a previous course about the LDS, the Mormons, which are really interesting because they are, I suppose, probably the biggest embedded system in our society. I mean, I don't know what the total number of Mormons is, but it's certainly in the many millions. They're important, you know, after all, one of them ran for president in the last election, and they're very successful. And they've got their own legal system, turns out. And I should say, the student who did the paper was a Mormon, and she interviewed her bishop for the paper, which I thought was rather neat. As with the Amish, the bishops are amateurs, although I don't think they're chosen by lot. And there are a lot of them. That's the bishop is a bishop over a fairly small group. No, they're not. They're appointed from above, so you've actually got a hierarchy in the Mormon church. And a whole process where you're baptized at 8, a boy officially becomes a priest at 12. There's a different passage for the women. I don't remember what it is, but in each case you've got a sequence of stages that you work up. In order to be allowed to go into the temple, you've got to have a temple recommend, which requires your bishop's approval. On the whole, like the Amish, they generally believe in obeying the over-government. But they do have various mechanisms that basically, if you break the rules sufficiently, you are not permitted to go into temple, into the temple in Salt Lake City, which is sort of a minor excommunication. There are stronger versions of those if you keep doing it. So that is such a system. So anyway, I guess all I'm saying is that various versions of excluding you, whether a centralized or a decentralized system, for norms it's generally decentralized, for a church with a hierarchy like the LDS or the Catholic Church, it can be centralized, are one way of doing it. And then the final way of enforcing your rules is by illegal punishments. All right, if you think about how the Sicilian Mafia enforces its rules, the answer is that presumably if you do things they disapprove of enough, they will kill you. Now, it's true, it's against the law of Italy, but the Italian state has been less than strikingly successful in spite of a lot of efforts in maintaining its control over what's going on in Sicily for quite a long time. But if you look at the stuff on the gypsies in the book, the chapter you read discusses the Roman Chal, where you're using illegal violence. I'll beat you up if you don't compensate me. And although most of you didn't read it, the chapter on the Calle, which describes their feuds. And the Calle feuds, they make stuff easier by using avoidance largely instead of violence. But in principle, violence is an option. They do have duels, for example, which involve violence. So these are all possibilities. And in that, presumably part of what that hinges on is the group having enough control over its own members so that nobody's going to report you. So that if you imagine a duel between two Calle, one of them gets killed, you're pretty sure that the relatives of the one who's killed aren't going to call the cops. That would be seen as a betrayal, as it were, of their own system and norms. So that's another one. One of the issues then, related to what I was saying before, is how you keep people inside your organization. And in particular, how you get people sufficiently wanting to be in so that the threat to expel is an effective threat, which is what a lot of these require. And one solution is what I think is the traditional gypsy solution, namely that the people in the community hate everybody outside and everybody outside hates them. And that means there really isn't a very good exit option if you're a member of that community, which is what they did. Another way is simply maintaining a culture so that people acculturated to it like it better. And I think it's pretty clear that that's true of the gypsies, and I think it's pretty clear that that's true of the Amish, that the Amish really believe, perhaps correctly, perhaps incorrectly, that they've got a better society than ours, than the English, which is what all of us are from their standpoint, because that's the language we speak, and that works. But then one issue that runs into for all of these systems is controlling acculturation, which means partly controlling the education of children. So that you run into conflicts with the gypsies don't want their kids going to the public schools. The Amish fought and won, basically, to maintain control of the education of their own kids. What's the biggest in U.S. example of a system of non-state schools?
Private schools?
Specifically Catholic schools. What's that coming out of? That's coming out of the 19th century, I think the 19th century Catholic immigrants, when the Protestant majority saw the public school system as a way of turning all of these immigrants into good Americans. And the immigrants weren't all that sure they wanted to be turned into good Americans, because good Americans were Protestants. And so the Catholics set up their own school system. At considerable cost, but they did it, and it's still with us. A smaller example, the black Muslims, the Nation of Islam, have their own school system. They did, I think they still do. And again, you know, if you want your people to believe that white people are devils and a whole bunch of sort of rather bizarre beliefs, all of which go along with what is, as far as they know, a moderately successful subculture, as it were, part of the way you do it is to limit the degree to which your kids are associating with other kids when they're growing up. Now, one issue which showed up, I mean, I mentioned in the chapter, but it showed up in particular in the case of the Amish, is the tension between wanting to keep people in and wanting to get them out. That is to say, if it isn't a serious cost to be expelled, then the threat of ostracism isn't worth much. But if it is a serious cause to be expelled, then very unhappy people stay inside your group, and that can cause internal conflict. And the evidence that I discussed in the chapter briefly, I just noticed as I was rereading it, that the discussion of the contrast between the Swiss and the German Amish, the Swiss being the 19th century immigrants whose home language is a version of Schweizerdeutsch, of the Swiss dialect of German, and the 18th century immigrants whose home language is a dialect of German that evolved in Pennsylvania in America from several different dialects. And these are noticeably different subsets. They identify themselves as different. And one of the differences is that the Swiss group mostly practice Strengmeidung, which means that if you've been expelled from your congregation, you aren't supposed to be let into any other congregation, at least not until your congregation has forgiven you, so to speak. Whereas most, though not all, of the others practice the weak version of Meidung, which basically says if you're expelled from your group, you can persuade another congregation to accept you without ever having made peace with your original group. So the Strengmeidung means that the cost of getting expelled is higher, that you're, unless you can satisfy them, which you might be able to do eventually, you are cut off largely from the people you grew up with. Whereas the weak Meidung, after you join another congregation, you can now associate with the members of your old congregation, including your own family, freely. You're a legitimate Amish, you're just a member of another congregation. And the comment was that on the one hand, they have a smaller defection rate, the Strengmeidung people, but on the other hand, they have a higher internal conflict rate. And you can see that that makes sense. And the similar related comment was made about the Schwarzentruber, who are, I think, German Amish, but German Amish of a very low, that is, strict school, that they have a low defection rate, but people who defect very far. That is, they don't just go to another similar group. They leave being Amish entirely. And all of that, I thought, was sort of intriguing. And it occurred to me that maybe the right solution, although it raises problems of its own, solution, if you imagine you're designing a system like this, is you want a system where it's hard to leave, but not so hard to get expelled. In other words, a system where the advantages of being in are large, consequently you don't want to leave. But troublemakers get kicked out. Consequently, you can maintain a sort of a reasonably peaceful system. So easy expulsion, hard voluntary expulsion. Not hard in the sense you can't do it, but costly expulsion. But that requires, of course, a mechanism to decide who the troublemakers are, and that could cause all sorts of internal conflicts as people are fighting over who controls the mechanism for exiling. Whereas if you make it easy to get out, now the troublemakers identify themselves by leaving. All right, if you sort of, again, think about the difference in designing systems between a system where you get your result by someone making a decision and a system where the result is spontaneous. Right? Think about the difference for a moment between a centrally planned economy and a market economy. All right? In both of them, you want to arrange that if there's a shortage of copper, more copper will be mined. In the centrally planned one, that requires the authority, the center, to see there's a shortage of copper and to give orders. In the market one, all that happens is when there's a shortage of copper, the price goes up and now it pays people to mine more copper. So in one case, it's, as it were, the mechanisms generate themselves. In the other, you've got to have somebody. Well, similarly, it's just occurs to me as an interesting analogy, if you have a system where it's pretty easy to leave the group, then people who are discontented identify themselves by leaving, don't need any mechanisms for exiling them. Whereas if you have one where leaving is really unpleasant, now you've got an effective threat, but at the same time, you now have to have some mechanism for driving people out if you don't want to have discontented people still there. Anyway, there's an old book called Voice and Exit, I think that's the title, which is discussing two different mechanisms for controlling organizations. And voice is go to the meeting and persuade the members of the organization to do something different. And exit is if you don't like it, leave. And again, those have sort of some of the same characteristics, and both of those exist in real-world institutions pretty routinely, right? I mean, if I don't like the way this university is run, one solution I have is to write letters to the president or to attend whatever the meetings are or whatever. Another is to say, I don't like this place, I'll leave. And the exit has the great virtue that you can do it all by yourself. And the secondary virtue, that the possibility of exit gives organizations an incentive to behave themselves in some sense, because otherwise they've got nobody to be organized with. I remember being told, I don't know if it's true or not, that there was some area in Africa where there was lots of empty land, essentially, and that when a village got sufficiently unhappy with its chief, the villagers would all leave, and the chief was then described as chief of the frogs, because that was all he had left to be chief of. And that's an interesting model for one way of controlling human behavior. All right, we're out of time, so...